This sun-sponsored morning sweeps through tasseled grasses and spread-armed trees into expectant nooks and corners of a hawk-eyed landscape. Not concerned about which of us is burdened from memories we have carried through our nation's scalded history, where you were star-crossed if you came out, black or red or yellow, if your God was not like theirs. Observe children, their small sounds splashing, laughing, and listen to the dead. We may still be able to boost our frayed limbs into the sky on fickle winds that spread passions along dark folds of clouds, designed to expose the ashes along with the truth. Designed to expose the ashes along with the truth.
Last week I didn't want to get bogged down in definitions as the sermon series just came out of the gate, but there's a few definitions I think will be helpful as we go forward. And the first word I want to define is race. Race is a social construct and a relatively recent one at that. It has absolutely no genetic basis whatsoever. As a PBS series on race in 2003 put it, two random Koreans may be as genetically different as a Korean and an Italian. There's really only one race, and that's the human race, and we're all part of it. A few other definitions that are helpful. One is prejudice. Prejudice is a prejudgment. It's an internal perspective. It's something that we all have. It seems to be an inherently human thing to have prejudices, feelings we have within, thoughts we have within. Discrimination is prejudice acted out. So that internal feeling becomes externally acted on. And we do have power over whether we discriminate. Systemic oppression is prejudice and discrimination committed by a group of people who have relatively more power against people who have relatively less power. So examples of systemic oppression include classism, heterosexism, and racism. Racism, then, is a particular form of systemic oppression. In this country, it is typically perpetrated by whites, who generally have more power, against people of color, who generally have less. So some definitions. One other thing I want to kind of get out on the table first today has to do with class and classism. I'm not going to talk a lot about class or classism until the fourth sermon of the series, but I don't want this to mean that I think it's not important. And a lot of you asked last week, well, what about class? Great question. It'll come. In our country, classism, and a lot of the world, classism and racism are interwoven. Look at the arc of Dr. King's career, and you see toward the end of his career, the end of his life, more and more concern about class, that he was killed in Memphis working for economic justice for sanitation workers, black and white sanitation workers. That symbolizes this increasing concern he had about class. So we'll get to that in Sermon 4. Enough preliminaries. My topic today is history, the history of race and racism within Unitarian Universalism. Why focus a whole sermon on this topic? Isn't my series really about where we're going, not about where we've been? Yeah, it is ultimately about where we're going, but I don't think we can figure out where to go unless we have a pretty good sense of the path we have trod together up to this point. At the least, if we're ignorant of our history, it will blindside us. At the most, we will be doomed to repeat our mistakes. Next week, I want to explore what we as a fellowship can do to move forward in this area of race. Before we do that, we need to honestly take stock of the path we have traveled as Unitarian Universalists to this point. Using images from the reading, we need to make sure that we look at the ashes as we sort through the scalded history of Unitarian Universalism. Overall, I would say that our Unitarian Universalist heritage regarding race is decidedly mixed. And I would hope this is not a shock to anyone here. The fact that we are more than 90% white today is not just the result of bad luck. It has a whole lot to do with this mixed record on race. You can see our mixed heritage regarding race in the issue of slavery, for one example. Unitarians and Universalists were all on all sides of this issue. Benjamin Rush, a Unitarian who was also one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, he was a staunch abolitionist. He tried hard to keep slavery out of our Constitution. Thomas Jefferson, at least a quasi-Unitarian, wrote beautiful words about freedom and equality and kept his slaves. In fact, did not free them even upon his death. The Unitarian minister Theodore Parker helped finance John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, and he was willing to use weapons as a defense of fugitive slaves. The Unitarian Charles Sumner from Massachusetts was the most fiery abolitionist in Congress. The Unitarian John C. Calhoun from South Carolina was one of the most avid champions of slavery and states' rights in the Capitol. Today I don't have time to give you an exhaustive review of Unitarian Universalist history. Instead, I want to give a few snapshots that I believe give a glimpse of this road that Unitarian Universalists have walked. The first snapshot is one that Mark Morrison Reed lifts up in a volume he edited on some of the black trailblazers in our faith. In October 1860, just a month before Lincoln's election as president, the American Unitarian Association held its annual meeting in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The Reverend William Jackson, a Baptist minister in New Bedford, an African-American, decided to attend the convention. He had found himself increasingly drawn to Unitarian theology. And then at the convention, he found himself so moved by a sermon that he decided then and there to convert to Unitarianism. And he hoped to bring his church along with him. So the next day at the convention, the last day of it, he rose to address the gathering. Perhaps the only African-American in the packed room, he announced his decision to convert to Unitarian Universalism. Two newspaper accounts of his speech that day mentioned that he also asked for money to support his church as they moved into the Unitarian fold. A third account reports that it wasn't Jackson who asked for money, but a New Bedford minister who was a Unitarian suggested that they take up a collection. Whatever the source of the request, $49 was raised and given to Reverend Jackson. By all accounts, his announcement of his conversion did not stir any sort of response besides the $49. No one jumped up to say, "Welcome. We're so glad you're here." Jackson was basically given his $49 and sent on his way. Not surprisingly, I suppose, he and his church remained Baptist. What would have happened if instead of giving Reverend Jackson $49 and you can go on your way now, what would have happened if we really welcomed him? What difference would that have made if we welcomed him with open and joyous arms? At the least, it was certainly a missed opportunity. It would be another 46 years into the 20th century before the first African-American was ordained to the Unitarian ministry. The next snapshot involves the Reverend Ethelred Brown, an African-American who founded a Unitarian church in Harlem in 1920. He had two dreams for Unitarianism, that there would be a thriving Unitarian church in Harlem, and that there would be some genuinely interracial Unitarian congregations. Neither part of his dream was received with much more enthusiasm than Reverend Jackson's conversion. Although Brown was fellowshipped as a Unitarian minister for a while in the 1920s, He was dropped from fellowship in 1929 because he was a nuisance. 6 years later, he was reinstated after he threatened a lawsuit. Then in 1937, a new president came into the American Unitarian Association, and the association's stance toward racism softened a bit, and the relationship with Reverend Brown became more congenial. Ethelred Brown wrote these words in 1947. At the beginning of my ministry, it was my task to keep the flag of Unitarianism flying in a segregated city within a city, to prove not to the world, but to Unitarians, that Negroes are capable of becoming Unitarians, and that therefore Unitarianism is a universal religion. The quotation goes on. The disturbing fact is that the churches of America approve segregation in the continuing existence of separate churches for whites and blacks. Our Unitarian churches are a current partner in this sorry business. My first dream is that one day in the not too distant future, our Unitarian churches will be genuinely interracial, and I mean in their pulpits as well as in their pews. What if the Unitarians had embraced Reverend Brown and his church in Harlem with open arms in the 1920s? Would it have made a difference? Following the Second World War, a few Unitarian congregations embraced Reverend Brown's dream of becoming interracial. Congregations in places like Chicago, Knoxville, Richmond, and Washington, D.C. made some notable progress toward fulfilling this dream. But at the same time, this progress was outweighed by many more Unitarian and Universalist congregations jumping onto the white flight bandwagon and abandoning inner city locations for the white suburbs. What might have happened if more of our congregations stayed put in inner cities? The next snapshot takes us to Selma, Alabama, 1965. After the bloody assault on protesters crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge, Unitarian Universalist ministers and lay leaders responded in droves to Dr. King's plea to come down to Selma. Something like 500 Unitarian Universalists immediately made the trip down there, including 140 UU ministers, about 20% of our whole ministry at the time. The Unitarian Universalist response to King's plea came into national prominence when the UU minister James Reeb was murdered following the second march across that bridge. The next snapshot comes quickly on the heels of Selma, this shining moment of Unitarian Universalist commitment to social and racial justice. The UU drama that followed Selma has been labeled the empowerment controversy. It played against the backdrop of an American society engulfed in the struggle over race. It was the time of race riots, Dr. King's assassination, the Black Empowerment Movement, the Black Panthers. The empowerment controversy in Unitarian Universalist history is recent enough history that I've talked to some of the participants in the drama, including at least one member of our fellowship. The acrimony and the rage are still palpable when you talk with people who went through the empowerment controversy. Mark Morrison Reed writes that because of that controversy, some lifelong friendships crumbled, marriages dissolved, careers were ended, and congregations were factionalized. It is a very challenging chapter in our UU history. In his book, Darkening the Doorways, Morrison Reed wades through the conflicting accounts and the powerful memories and feelings and tries to unravel just what happened. Here in a nutshell is the story as he's reconstructed it. Following the race riots in 1967 in the summer, the Unitarian Universalist Association's Commission on Race and Religion convened an emergency conference. During the course of that conference, 34 African-American ministers and laypeople withdrew from the meeting and formed the Black UU Caucus. They later rejoined the conference and brought with them two non-negotiable demands.
the creation of the Black Affairs Council, whose members would be chosen by the Black UU Caucus, and UU Association funding for the Black Affairs Council to the tune of $250,000 a year for 4 years. After heated debate, the Commission on Race and Religion approved the demands and passed them on to the UU Association's Board of Trustees. The board quickly fractured over these demands. In the end, the board declined to fund the Black Affairs Council, but set up a fund and said they could apply for money. The following spring, a Black UU Caucus conference drew about a third of the estimated 600 Unitarian Universalists at the time. Meanwhile, a group formed to counter the Black Empowerment Movement in the UU Association. The new group eventually settled on the name Black and White Action. Its vision was a colorblind society. Its focus was on getting blacks and whites working together. It asked for money, too. And it's important to know that there were whites and blacks who supported each of these groups. The struggle between these two groups dominated the next two national gatherings of UUs. We call them General Assemblies. The struggle nearly led to a schism. In the end, the General Assembly voted to fund the Black Affairs Council at the $250,000 level for 4 years, and also voted $50,000 for the Black and White Action Group, a solution which left both groups completely unhappy. And then, facing a calamitous financial situation, the UA board voted later to spread out those payments, the $1 million, to the Black Affairs Council over 5 instead of 4 years. The Black Affairs Council rejected this, disaffiliated from the UA, and went on its own to raise funds, an effort which ultimately failed, and the controversy slowly died down. The empowerment controversy left all sides reeling, people feeling, in Morrison Reed's words, betrayed, victimized, and misunderstood. In the wake, some African-American Unitarian Universalists abandoned our faith, some never to return. Some others, including William Sinkford, the first person of color elected UUA president back in 2001, eventually returned. The 1980s and 90s saw the UU Association turn its attention to racism within the institutional practices of the UU Association and member congregations. It was, I'm sure, I know, an important angle to pursue. As I suggested last week, a lot of these efforts, I think, got bogged down in a focus on white guilt, which proved not to be very productive. At the same time, however, we had the beginnings of a really serious engagement with Reverend Ethelred Brown's dream of people of color becoming Unitarian Universalist ministers. The number of UU ministers of color grew from 7 in 1993 to 17 in 2001 to 55 last year, with 40 students of color in our seminaries. Another positive development in recent years has been a growing understanding that race and racism within the UU Association is not just a black-white issue, but it also includes Hispanic, Native American, and other non-white ethnicities. More on this one next week. So, some snapshots. I think they reveal an ongoing pattern of courageous steps, courageous people, missed opportunities, and good intentions gone awry. Every step forward seemed to either be accompanied by or quickly followed by a step backward. And the result of all this is painfully evident today in our faith continuing to be, as I said last week, largely a white ethnic faith. So, what has gotten in the way of us realizing the Reverend Brown's dream for an interracial Unitarian Universalism? If we are to escape this pattern that has thus far ensnared us, we will need to understand these roadblocks. And if we don't understand them, if we don't deal with them, Unitarian Universalism will remain a declining faith, a white ethnic faith, in a nation where whites are becoming a minority. So today I want to lift up 5 primary roadblocks that I see. The first is simple and obvious. Racism of individual Unitarian Universalists as well as our congregations and our whole association. Obliviousness, which I talked about last week. Obliviousness about white power, for example, is a way that this has worked to hold us back. Second roadblock to me is a shortcoming of our liberal theology. And in one of the services last week, we talked a little bit about this, but we have a hard time acknowledging, let alone accounting for, the presence of human sin and the suffering human sin results in our theology. When I think about racism, I really can think of no better word to describe it than sin. Our reluctance to use this powerful descriptive word has hobbled us in our efforts to understand and dismantle racism. It has also, I would guess, made Unitarian Universalism less attractive to oppressed people who, having been on the receiving end of racism, are much too familiar with sin to deny its existence. Third roadblock, I think, is our elitism. This has played out particularly in our reluctance to evangelize, to share our faith. A smug self-satisfaction has kept us from wanting others to join us, especially others who might actually have a chance to change the comfortable status quo in our congregations. So we've never bothered ourselves much with intentional outreach to non-white communities. Fourth roadblock for me is our focus on individualism. Our preference for the individual rather than the collective has caused us repeatedly to think about racism in terms of individual racists and individual victims of racism. It's caused us to overlook the systemic aspect of it. It's caused us too often to stay in the land of, well, my best friend's coworker is black and I'm nice to that person. It has prevented us from taking seriously enough the systemic nature of racism. Last on my list of roadblocks is our tendency to leap to the ideal of colorblindness as quickly as we possibly can. As mostly white liberals, Unitarian Universalists have always wanted to get to that ideal where color doesn't matter, where it's all about the content of our characters. This is what the Black and White Action Group back in the empowerment controversy wanted to get to. They wanted to just forget about the skin color stuff, forget about ethnicity, let's just get along and work together. Unfortunately, we weren't then or now near enough to the end of systemic oppression to be able really to forget about skin color and ethnicity. It turns out that color blindness has been a good way for Unitarian Universalists to ignore racism, to pretend it doesn't exist. It tends to make us blind not just to color. In color, we're all programmed to notice as human beings, but to make us blind to racism as well. And now, friends, the stage is set for next week's focus. What can we do to create a more just world, especially in the fellowship and in our individual lives? For those of you who have been itching for solutions, next week is your week. But I must warn you, none of them are easy.